Have you ever been contacted by a loved one who has died? Hello from heaven? I hope it's hello from heaven and not someplace else. Up next, as we talk with Bill Guggenheim, a new field of research, after-death communication, confirming that life and love are eternal. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Looking forward to tonight. Bill Guggenheim and his former wife, Judy, conducted 7 years of research on after-death communication for their work, Hello from Heaven. During this time, they interviewed 2,000 people, collected more than 3,300 first-hand accounts of after-death communication experiences. Bill is on the board of advisors of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, member of the Association for Death Education and Counseling, and represents workshops at conferences for bereavement support groups, hospices, churches, colleagues, many other types of institutions. Here he is back on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, how are you?
Wonderful, George. So nice to be speaking with you again.
And nice work, by the way, you and Judy. Hello from heaven.
Thank you.
And I kind of made a little spoof about it. I hope it's hello from heaven and not hello from hell.
I think we have enough of that in the political and economic news.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Tell me a little bit about what's been going on and some more of your background. It's been over a year, Bill, since you've been on with me.
Actually, about a year and a half, to be honest. Yep. And let me, I guess, start off with who I used to be, because in a way it's 180 degrees opposite. I used to be a stockbroker and a securities analyst in New York City on Wall Street. And I was very much a materialist and kind of a yuppie kind of thing. And I compared people to flashlight batteries. And I believed that when they died, it was like the battery ran out of juice and you just threw the body away. Same as a flashlight battery. And I did not believe in life after death or anything like that. I used to argue against it. So I was very much a agnostic at the very least, maybe more. And so you would never thought I'd ever be on the phone talking to anybody about a topic like this.
And when you and Judy started to conduct these after-death communication research studies, how did you find the people?
Well, basically, I would go any place I could. I live in Orlando, outside of Orlando, Florida.
Yeah.
And I would go to any kind of a group I could where they would allow me to speak for about 2 to 3 minutes and just describe what we thought we were talking about. We had made up a one-page flyer, and I was just basically saying, have you been contacted by anybody who's died? Very simple language. And I would notice heads bobbing up and down and people smiling. Not many, but three or four wherever I went. And I would go up to them afterwards to get their name and phone number, address, and we began interviewing people in person. And my job was to try to find 10 people a week, not knowing if I could or couldn't. And we did, and much to my surprise, we interviewed 500 people the very first year of our work. I never thought we'd hit that.
That's huge.
I had no idea how big this field was. And then from there on, as we learned about various bereavement support organizations, you know, for bereaved parents, the widowed, you name it, all different kinds, we found out that many of them had newsletters, so we'd write to them and say, would you put this little announcement in your newsletter? And many of them did. They were very kind and contained their name, address, phone number. And people began calling us, writing us to tell us about their experiences. And later on, we had newspaper stories. Some were small, some were large.
It grows, doesn't it?
And this is why we were doing our research. I'm not a medical doctor or a PhD. I'm an unknown person, basically. But there was a great interest in the topic. And we had newspaper stories circulated both in the United States and Canada. And it just went on and on and on.
Tell me a little bit about the way you did your study and your research, how you set up the method of this.
Well, the basic thing was very simple, to just work out a series of questions, standard questions, because we interviewed people in person initially, then later over the phone. So we'd ask the person about their background and their age and their occupation, all the basic data, and also some questions to ascertain that they were not drinking or on drugs.
Would they admit that?
No, but you could tell.
I'm not drinking, well.
No, this is when they had their experience. And
okay.
You, after a while, when you deal with enough people in the public, you get a sense of who's sincere and who
that's
less
true.
Sincere.
Absolutely.
And I can only put it that way. And we didn't put anything in the book unless we had three experiences that were very, very similar. So in a sense, these experiences confirmed one another. And actually, as you do these kind of research, you find so many accounts that are so similar. It's just the wording and the relationship, the age, those things are different. But the majority of the information is very, very much alike within the 12 categories that we uncovered.
Was there anyone who influenced your work?
Well, the very first and strongest influence I had was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
One of the best.
The best, because I had seen her on the Phil Donahue show, and that show was run 2 weeks later and had her name and address at the bottom. And very magnanimously, I sat down and wrote a check for $25 and mailed it off to her and thought that would be, you know, my good deed for the day. But much to my surprise, she invited me to attend a five-day workshop with her, and I did about 6 months later. And I heard accounts by a bereaved mother there and also by one of Elizabeth herself, which absolutely rocked me because she spoke of a patient who had died 10 months earlier and came back to her. And I'd never heard of anything like that, and nor had anybody else in the workshop. There were about 70 of us. And this was startling information. And I figured, well, if one person has had an experience where someone who's totally deceased has come back.
I hear Fido in the background.
Yes. A little bit stuck at the moment.
Nothing like live radio here.
Yes.
I love it.
I'm moving away as much as I can.
That's right.
He's at the door.
I may end up interviewing Fido later.
Right.
I never know.
I never know. Hearing her experience and knowing that she was had everything to lose and nothing to gain by telling it to us as a group, that really piqued my interest. So when I came home from that five-day workshop, I began doing research. And sure enough, I would find one experience here, two there, occasionally an entire chapter in a book on this topic, but nobody had ever named the experiences, and nobody had ever systematically analyzed them and put them into any kind of order. And I felt, at first, I doubted myself because I didn't think, if I write a book, who's going to publish it? Because I'm not, you know, in those fields, as a psychiatrist, psychologist, or whatever. But later on, I received information that I should just go ahead, do my own research, write my own book, and it would take care of itself. And sure enough, that did happen.
This influence that she had on you, did it pinpoint your ability to change your research or to develop the kind of research that you ultimately used?
It was very simple. Well, first of all, I had developed a great interest in near-death experiences, which Raymond Moody wrote the first book on,
mm-hmm.
Life After Life. And by reading many of those books and attending conferences of people who had near-death experiences and hearing their accounts, it was just a matter of really transferring the information from one field to another and how to gather information. And yes, it did require adaptation and finding new ways to interview people for our work. But what we also found is that people who had a story and could tell it well would just say, please tell it to us, and you just hold up a microphone and a tape recorder.
And let it go.
Let it go. And other people could have a tremendous experience. It's like pulling teeth, especially some men.
Welcome to the world of radio.
Yes. So somebody could have a small experience, but they had a very interesting way to relate it and with color to it, so to speak, and make it interesting. And another person could have a full experience of their deceased father or mother or whoever it is. And, boy, it was so painful to try to extract the experience.
And have you continued to chart the same path now in your studies?
Yes. Basically, we have a huge website over, I guess, 2.5 million visits. People send us every day. They send us their experiences, and we get some by mail still, but mostly it's on the internet. And sometimes people just call me. I just hear lovely experiences on the phone.
Well, of course, those websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. And when we come back, Bill, I want to ask you about your work now with the after-death communication experience, or what we all call ADC. I'm George Norrie, back with Bill Guggenheim. Hello from Heaven, next on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, in Hello from Heaven, you have 353 first-hand accounts of your research after-death communication. Let's talk about that. In your opinion, what is this after-death communication?
Well, let me tell you my own personal experience, because that's the one I'm most of all familiar with. And this was 3 years after I attended the five-day workshop with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And Judy and I were living here in Florida. We were married at the time. We had three sons. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and we had finished a conversation in the front of our house in the living room. And we each got up to move to do something else. I don't remember what it was, but I very clearly heard a voice in my head say, "Go outside and check the swimming pool." We had a four-bedroom house with a screened-in pool, which is a very standard thing here in Central Florida, throughout Florida. And I didn't feel any sense of emergency involved. Mm-hmm. I just heard the message, and I obeyed it. I just walked from the front of the house in the living room to the sliding glass doors in the rear of the house and saw that there was a patio there. About 15 feet away, we had a wrought iron fence with a gate in it, and that was a safety gate for our three sons and any other children who came by. You're required to have protection around the pool. And I noticed the gate was ajar, so I just opened the sliding glass doors and went to the gate to close it securely. And as I did, I happened to look down toward the deep end of the pool, and there I saw our youngest son, Jonathan, who's only 21 months old at that point, floating in the water. He was not moving.
Horrible.
He was not near the side of the pool. He was several feet away from it, and he was just floating. And my heart symbolically or literally leapt to my throat. And I raced down the side of the pool, screeched out Judy's name. And just before I went into the water, for some reason, I took my shoes off. I heard you're supposed to do that. I took my shoes off, and I looked at his face. And he seemed to be smiling. His eyes were wide open. But most of all, he seemed to be at least 1 inch under the water. His face was under the water. And I couldn't see that he was breathing or not. I had no way of knowing if he'd already drowned or whatever. But I jumped into the water, came up under him, pushed him to the side. And Judy had heard my screech and came running out. And she pulled him out, grabbed him by the wrist, pulled him out of the pool. And didn't know what to expect. I climbed out cold. It was March. The water was still cold here.
Yeah.
And within a matter of a few seconds, he coughed a few times and spit up some water, and Jonathan was fine. He did not even require CPR.
Amazing.
And an act of grace, of course. And I believe that the voice that I heard speak to me telepathically was that of my father, who had died when I was a little boy, 8 years old, 33 years ago. And obviously that had a profound effect upon me. And cutting way ahead to the story here, we have an entire chapter in Hello from Heaven of people whose lives were protected or saved by a loved one who had died. And I'd like to alert your listeners, especially if they, or for instance, the most common one is when you're driving a car. If you ever get a premonition or a feeling, or especially if you hear somebody say stop or slow down or go a different direction or a different roadway, do it. You have nothing to lose except maybe some time. And we have a number of accounts in the book where people did follow that advice and prevented themselves being rammed by, say, a semi, you know, tractor trailer.
Great story, though, Bill.
And on and on and all, in all different ways. And other things to look out the window, and the woman saw that the barn was on fire. If she hadn't been alerted, that would have set the house on fire and all the rest of it. Another woman was flying a plane. She couldn't find an airport until finally she was directed to look in a certain direction, and she did find a small airport in the middle of a rural area to land her plane. So there are all kinds of assistance available from the other side, from deceased loved ones, to guide them or to prevent them from having a serious accident or being killed themselves.
You talk about the fact that at least 60 million Americans have some kind of after-death communication experience.
Yes,
60
and that's
million.
Our conservative estimate. I've always wanted to be on the conservative side, not a sensationalist. And yet there's a Catholic priest, Father Andrew Greeley, who did extensive studies on this, and he arrived at the figure was like 42% of all Americans, which would make the figure about 120 million people. So it's over 40%. I mean, I think it's more between the two, maybe 30% or something like that, say 100 million Americans. But whatever it is, it's very, very large. And just like, you know, at one point people did not talk about near-death experiences, going through a tunnel toward the light, you know, almost dying and whatnot. Well, people are talking about these now much more than they used to, but it's still not an open subject. People don't want to be, you know, weird, different, strange, or anything like that. And yet they do have the experiences. They share them with their family members or their closest friends, things like that. And occasionally now we see them getting published in newspapers or various websites online, things of that nature.
What determines an ADC? What type of contact do you have to have?
We coined the term, and we stick by it. We're the first ones to write a book or do any research on this field, and we named it after-death communication. And by that we mean that an after-death communication is a spiritual experience that occurs when someone is contacted directly and spontaneously by a family member or friend who has died. And by directly, we mean that there is no third parties involved. There are no psychics or mediums or seances or Ouija boards or anything like that.
One-on-one.
One-on-one. And then that way, there's no manipulation or anything. And spontaneously means that our deceased family member or friend determines when, where, and how to contact us. Obviously, if you're a bereaved parent or a widow or widower, really love your spouse, that kind of thing. People yearn to have these experiences, but you can want them, but you don't necessarily have them. You have to be open and fortunate, and the other one who's died wants to make contact with you and these kinds of things. So we haven't even come across people fantasizing these, believe it or not, as many experiences we've had. There are some that sound very strange, yes, and I don't consider them ADCs, but very, very few. But people who do want them sometimes do have, some have a series of them, some have just one.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they have different contacts with different family members or friends over their lifetime, all different patterns. And a few are very fortunate, like a husband and wife who've been married many, many years and had a very close relationship. They may have ongoing communication for the rest of the years of the life of the one who's still alive.
When you did your research, how long did you have to spend with each individual?
Well, it's a process, actually. So, let's just say they wrote to us or I contacted them, whatever. I would call them and I would screen them first, me personally. So I spoke to all the people we interviewed and probably 2,000 more. So in other words, someplace between 3,000 and 5,000 people I spoke to. And I'd listen to their stories and I decided whether or not we would actually pursue an interview. And if I wanted to, I would write down all the information and give it to one of the interviewers. The interviewers were women. I felt that they would be better because many people become very emotional as they tell these stories.
Oh, of course. And was it hard culling them down to 353?
Yes. Book? You asked how long. So the typical interview is at least 30 minutes, typically 40, 45, 50 minutes. And if people had multiple experiences, that would take that much more time to interview each person. So some went over an hour, and this is when phone calls are 15 cents per minute. So that's not the case today, but it was a factor back then.
Who generally, in terms of the family member who did the visiting, the dead family member, was it a grandmother as opposed to a mother or a father? Do you have any data there, Bill?
No, we didn't do that kind. We do have a database where I recorded over 100 pieces of information per experience. However, we didn't break it down in that way in the book because it would have been very boring, statistical information. But virtually everybody has come back and can come back. So that makes no difference. Of course, the ones who yearn for these experiences the most are bereaved parents. That's who I've done the most workshops for, most conferences, conventions, and all that. And many of their children have come back. And the child can be everything from stillborn to neonatal death or crib death, as they call it, the SIDS, any age, any form of death. Some, of course, die from illness, some from accident. The other two forms are murder or suicide.
Do pets come back?
We do have a few accounts in our files of pets, but we didn't put them in our book. We thought that would be too far out. But we do have some that involve dogs, cats, one rabbit, and a beautiful story involving a horse.
These visitations, are they to help someone, give advice, save someone from dying like your little boy?
There are different motivations, but the most common one is to let us know, we the living, that they still exist. They're okay. They're fine. We need not be concerned about them. Life continues. And they're, I believe the motivation is always love. Their love for us and wanting to help us with our grief and our loss and concern and all the normal questions that people have about the one who died. And they're also letting us know that when we make our transition, they will be there to meet us and greet us on the other side. And in some cases, perhaps to even help us to make our transition.
And that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes.
The intervention, how often is it, you know, I'm going to use the word physical for a moment, but the truck driver who's going over the side of a road and someone reaches on his wheel and pulls him back on. And what's the distinction between the family member with an ADC and an angel?
Okay, that's a very tough question, but generally the person, or at least the experiences we put in our book, the person knew who it was who had contacted them. And if it was vague or they didn't know or indicated it would be something like an angel or some other being like that, we did not include within our research. We feel that that's very sacred, very personal, very beautiful, very uplifting material, but we just did not include it within our parameters of our work. And we did hear those stories, but basically we only included ones that involved a relative or a friend, someone they had known.
So that's what you keyed in on?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And we're not denying the reality of the others anyway.
Of course not. No.
But it just, we had to set some boundaries for our work. Just like we did not include hauntings and, you know, sounds, you know, in a new house and, you know, footsteps or, you know, things like that. Things that go bump at the night, we did not include those. It had to be a relative or a friend.
Describe a little bit more of the kinds of experiences.
Basically, we found that these fell into 12 major categories. And the most common one is just literally feeling or sensing the presence of the one who's died. And you just know he or she is near you. People typically know where they are.
You don't see the spirit.
You don't see anything. You just feel. It's a sense of, many people can be in a room and then they can sense the energy of somebody who walks in.
Sure.
Without hearing the footsteps or anything like that. You just know it. It's an inner knowing, I'd say. In this case, they just know that that person there is there. And who it is. They sometimes say there's an increase of warmth in the room or of coldness in that area. Not that often, but that's part of it. And they know when the person has come and when they leave. But again, all these can occur simultaneously. We have to describe them individually to make it clear. But when people do sense the presence, they typically will say, well, I must be imagining this because this may take place within hours or days of the death of their loved one. But so they tend to discount this very easily and very frequently.
All right, what else are the part of those?
Obviously, you get into hearing a voice, which is very common. And people hear a voice telepathically, not with their ears like where we hear each other on the phone or in person.
Right.
But it's in their head, just like I heard my father's voice saying, go outside and check the swing pool.
Yeah.
They get a message in their head, and it's very definite who's speaking to them and what's being said, and sometimes there's two-way communication.
How do you know you're not just being intuitive?
I think that these are intuitive experiences, but when you receive information that's specific and you get a sense of the presence, meaning the sound of the voice or the nature of the person who's speaking to you.
You could tell.
It's going beyond. I've had intuitive experiences. We all have. And we do call these intuitive experiences. I much prefer that word to the word psychic experiences. That puts it in another whole realm. So we do call people who are intuitive and more open are much more likely to have these experiences. But it's not just a sense of doing or not doing or something, but rather actually having some sense of the communication from that person to you.
Does there seem to be some kind of relief after the living person gets this communication?
Almost everyone feels comforted by these experiences. And there's no one experience that's going to remove all the grief, unless it's a very distant relative or something like
that.
Sure.
But somebody you hardly knew.
Obviously, if your daddy, your mom, your spouse, your child, if they have 10 experiences, they wanted 11th they have 11, they want 12. But they do shorten the duration of the grief, and they lessen the sting of the grief, I would say.
Do you ever go online or look in the newspaper at the obit column? Everybody does.
I'm familiar with the newspaper, yes.
I mean, it's not like we do it for a living, but I mean,
I've done it at times when I expected to see somebody in there, yes.
Well, it's amazing, you know, for example, like in St. Louis or L.A., how many people are dying every day?
Yes.
I mean, every day. So of those, I would guess then that percent will come back to try to communicate. How quickly do they come back?
Some come back literally almost at the time of their death. People will say that's how they had the experience before they even knew that their loved one died. We have an entire chapter of those. We call it Before the News. So you may be visited by whoever it was who made their transition, and whatever form of contact it is, feeling the presence, hearing a voice, smelling a fragrance, seeing them, whatever. And then later, especially if you're at a distance, let's say I'm in Florida, you're in California, wherever you are, maybe tomorrow I get an email or a phone call or something like that, and then I learn that they died at a certain time, but I only learned it after I had the experience first.
Interesting.
And so, and the other, the opposite of that is having an experience many years later. In other words, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 or more years after the death. So these aren't limited within time.
It truly is amazing. Here's the big question. Why? Why do they come back? Why do they try to comfort us or help us?
I've never thought of expressing it this way. Let's just say back in the olden days when travel wasn't as easy as it is now and communications aren't as easy as they are now,
Yeah. You
took a trip to some foreign country. Would you want to let your family members or whatever know that you're okay, you've arrived safely, and not for them to be unduly concerned about you? You're perhaps conducting business there, and everything's fine, and you expect to return on time, etc.
Jimmy Hoffa used to tell his family where he was going and what he was doing almost all the time. And I think that's one of the reasons they realized back in July 75 when he disappeared, something's wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
Dad hasn't told us where he's going or what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he just doesn't leave and not tell us. I guess maybe that's the same for the after death.
Also, as prevalent as these experiences are in the United States, are even more common in other countries. For instance, in Central and South America, parts of Europe, and even Asia, especially the Catholic countries, Spanish Catholic, Irish Catholic, Italian Catholic countries, where people are more open, where there's almost a folklore mixed with their religion, a folk religion with their basic, you know, other, whatever their faith is. Those people seem to be more open, and they don't see life as final and death is something else. We make a very strong distinction between the two. And this, and in other parts of the country, of the world, people have these experiences far more readily, say at night, and they talk about them and share them with their friends the next day, next week, during the next week, and as part of the grieving ritual, grief ritual, and to talk about it and confirm each other's, validate each other's experiences and says, yes, my son did that too, or my father was just like that, et cetera, et cetera.
We'll be back with more. We're going to get some examples about children and older children as well, hospice, much more. Later on, you'll share your stories. We'll get your questions with Bill Guggenheim, author, Hello from Heaven, that he wrote with Judy, in just a moment. Let's talk about some more of the cases. Let's start with the younger children first, Bill. Give us some more examples.
Okay. Basically, we've divided them into three categories, as I'll explain. If a child is very young, like the youngest one, I think, is about a year and a half old, mm-hmm. about 2.5 years old, we can't interview anybody that young, so we take the report from their parents or whoever was caretaking
sure.
them at the time. If they're older and we say, I think, 8 years old to 18, we can interview them directly, which we did. And then finally, many people had an experience who are currently adults. They had an experience when they were a child, so we interviewed many of those people. But one of the very cute ones, I think, is that there was a little 2.5-year-old boy father died. They used to call him Papa.
Papa. That's what mine call me, by the way.
Mm-hmm. And Papa used to sit on a chair outside on the porch of the house, and this little boy used to have a swing out there when he was at that time, or even younger. And his grandfather used to push him in the swing and stuff like that. And then his mother reported that one evening, after she had put her son Ryan down to sleep, all of a sudden he popped up and was looking out the window. She said about 10 o'clock at night, and he was waving and smiling at the porch. And she said he looked at me, and he was saying, "Mommy, Mommy, it's Papa, it's Papa." And he was smiling and waving. I didn't know what to think, and I said, "Ryan, lie down." He said, "No, Mommy, Papa is smiling at me. Papa is waving." And at that point, I picked him up and took him to my mother's room and whatnot. And why would a child 2.5 years old suddenly begins waving and smiling and calling out Papa and then suddenly cease? They're too young to be impressionable by TV or anything else. You don't even see this on TV, frankly. And
That's so cool. You
get very young children like this, and there are a whole variety of different types of situations the parents have reported to us. Let's see, I've got a whole bunch here. It's just a question of which one I choose.
Okay.
There was a boy a little bit, I think about 6 or 7, who we interviewed, that he saw an elderly man in his room, or by his standards, an elderly man, and he didn't know who he was. And he didn't tell anybody about it, but he noted some of the features of this man and his clothing and other whatever he saw. And then later on, he was going through a family photo album. And again, he didn't reveal anything, but he saw the man he had seen in his vision. And he asked his mother or grandmother, somebody like that, "Who is this?" And it turned out to be his great-grandfather, Victor.
Amazing.
And this is not the kind of stuff children would make up.
No.
It just isn't.
No.
And
they're not delusional.
No. And there are a whole series of all these things. I don't want to go on and on and on with all these cases, but there was a very interesting one in that there were two young boys, and this one boy was in his room, and his friend visited him. And he knew his friend had died, but that's all he knew. He didn't know how or what had happened. And he saw his friend, and they talked a while, and he seemed whole and healthy at this point. And he told his parents about it the next morning, and he explained that he had learned from his friend that his friend had drowned and that he had hit his head, the back of his head. Now, the boy had not been told that his friend had drowned in a pool. And even the authorities, they did an autopsy and everything, they didn't know what had caused the death of the boy in the pool, the drowning, because he was a very good swimmer, and there was no witness present.
Right.
But they figured he could certainly handle himself. But apparently what he had done was, as going into the pool, he just happened to slip and hit the back of his head just hard enough to either make him unconscious or woozy or whatever and sink to the bottom and not be able to swim. And yet, he came to his friend and explained all this. And there was also a man with red hair who would come. And the boy who narrated this account didn't have any idea who that was, nor did the boy's parents know. And so they went over and told the parents of the boy who had drowned what their son had told them. And asked, by the way, "Who is the man with the red hair?" And that was the boy's grandfather. There was no way their son could have known this.
I was going to say also, do some of these cases involve two or more entities visiting the individual?
Occasionally. Usually it's one, but occasionally it's two, like it was with a grandfather.
Yeah.
And I think it makes it more evidential, more real, more tangible. I think one of the cutest stories I heard, and this one I remember very well, was a mother and a father who had been married quite a few years. They had grown daughters and everything in their 30s. So they had been married many years, and then the father had died. And the mother was absolutely sure her deceased husband would come back to her. I mean, she just knew it. But he didn't. And, they waited a while. And then they had two daughters in their 30s. and she was sure that he would come to one of his daughters, and he didn't. And, like, what's going on? Why isn't, you know, let's say Tom, why hasn't Tom shown up? And then one night, or one evening, one of the daughters came over with her four-year-old son, and they had dinner with Grandma, and then they put the boy down to bed at, I don't know what time, 8 or 9 o'clock, whatever is appropriate for a four-year-old. And then the daughter stayed on for a while to visit. And then sometime later, the young boy came running out of the where he was sleeping, yelling, "Grandpa's in my room! Grandpa's in my room!" And that's who the grandfather had come to visit. And sometimes it's easier. What we have learned that the grief is a barrier, as well as anger. And wanting something very much, sometimes wanting it too much, is a barrier.
Do they ever talk, Bill, about the future?
We have very little about that. I'd say virtually nothing of a prognostication of, you know, fortune-telling, future.
So it's really current events, a warning, or
something right in the
little hello.
Basically in the moment. Basically it's to provide comfort, reassurance, consolation, things of that nature, and other times to warn of impending danger. And we do have an entire chapter in our book, Hello from Heaven, of people who were suicidal and actually were thinking of taking their life, and two were in the process of taking their life. One of deceased family member or friend came to them at just the right moment. And it wasn't that they had any magical words, but just coming and saying something or showing up in some way deterred them from continuing with their suicidal plans. They didn't do that, or we could not have interviewed them. And I especially hope that psychologists and other people who work with people who are suicidal hear this, because they could very easily say, "Oh, come on, you're fantasizing that. That's not real." And put them on more medication or whatever, and undo what might save their life if they just accepted that maybe now and then somebody does come back to help somebody who's deeply disturbed.
Years ago, I had a caller who called the program. It was a woman. Had a son who was distraught. She said she went outside into the garage, and there he was hanging from one of the rafters. He had hung himself. He wasn't dead yet. She said she was able to grab him. Now, this is not a big woman by any means.
Sure.
Frail, elderly. She grabbed him by the legs, and she said, "George, as God is my judge, some entity, I don't know who it was, whether it was his father who had died, or an angel, but some entity gave her the strength." She could literally see extra arms pushing him up, holding him up until a neighbor came by and they helped get him down. Incredible story.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we live in a far more wondrous universe than we ever realize. And when I say universe, I mean right here on Earth. We don't have to go way out in the cosmos and all that, and you know what's happening and going to happen in 2012. You know, it's all very fascinating, but right here, right now, it's a very magical world, and in a positive sense, a very wondrous world. And one of the things I'm just learning is how powerful prayer is.
Oh, it's huge. Oh, my gosh.
I just wish people could do some studies and show the difference in how quickly people heal when they're prayed for.
And to me, the definition of prayer, Bill, isn't religious.
No.
It's this combination of tapping into this force through what we call consciousness or prayer.
Yes. And for me, that force is love, because when we are praying for somebody, I'm not talking about praying for winning the lottery and winning or getting a job or, you know, all the material things, but when we pray for somebody to receive emotional and spiritual assistance, or maybe even physical assistance if they're, you know, having surgeries, things like that, and we're doing it for someone else especially, it's love. We are transmitting love to them and surrounding them with love and seeing them surrounded by love and light and all those good things. And we may call upon higher spiritual beings. That's fine. There's no reason not to. But it is love that does heal.
Now, when you talked about the categories of the children, you had the real young ones, and then you had the middle kids. How about a few stories there? And then you went into the older kids.
Yeah, we interviewed one of the most interesting stories was a teenage boy whose grandfather had died. And the grandfather had been a master plumber all his life. And he would visit his grandson from time to time and teach him all these things about plumbing. And when we interviewed him on the telephone and everything, and when we went to write up the transcript of what he said, we didn't know how to spell the names of the tools he named. We didn't know what he was talking about. We called Home Depot, we called, you know, like Lowe's, people like that, and they didn't know these tools because these were more antiquated. These were older ones.
The older ones, yeah.
And finally we did hit a man who is like retired or so close to it, who had worked with such tools and knew what a left-handed something was, or I don't even remember the nomenclature right now. But it was very humorous and frustrating to have to try to describe stuff.
And I know what you mean. I've got plumbers in St. Louis, and they've been around 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they go way back.
Yeah, and they use different tools than they do today, and this boy knew them. And speaking of St. Louis, you'll love this story. You remember the baseball team, the St. Louis Browns?
Well, I wasn't there at the time. I was in Detroit, but yes, I do.
Okay.
They went on to become the Baltimore Orioles,
right.
Didn't they? Yeah. At the time.
Don't know if they what team they became, but we.
I think they.
This is a story I heard at a workshop about a boy who, I think it was an uncle, had been on the St. Louis Browns. And the uncle had died, but that was his passion in life and everything. That was what he had done in his life, the way of work and everything. And he came back and he taught his nephew the names of the players, their positions, the relative, the real good batters, the good fielders. This boy was a treasure trove of information about a baseball team that had long since ceased being before he ever was born. How do you explain that?
You can't.
You see?
And they did move to Baltimore in 1954.
Okay.
Someone's
right.
Already sent me a message. That's fast.
There you go. It's the age of information.
Mm-hmm. You have looked at after-death communications with people who are dying, hospice experiences.
Yeah, we call them hospice experiences because it's at and around the time of death. And there's a new field of researcher that has emerged calling Nearing Death Awareness. And there are two wonderful books, if anybody's interested in this. One is called Final Gifts, and the other is Final Journeys. And Maggie Callanan is a hospice nurse. She wrote the first one with another woman, and then she wrote Final Journeys herself. And this is a very dedicated hospice nurse who's spent countless hours with dying patients in their homes and learned their symbolic language and their behaviors and what they mean behind their words. For instance, people may say, I want to go home. Well, wait a minute. They're in their own home. They must be addled in their mind. They must be confused. What they mean is home for them is heaven, the other side, and things like that. That's a whole different language that people use.
Are people in hospice experiences, are they calm or are they scared?
Frankly, it's everything. Everything you can think of, because it depends on the person involved. Some people fear death, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross used to say, people die in character. And those who live life fearfully, die fearfully. And those who live life easily and openly and adventurously move forward through the transition process easily as well. And so people are hanging on, and that's why they'll have, one more surgery and one more this and one more that, and try to prolong life by the day, the week, the month, and others couldn't care less. I'm ready to go.
Have you ever seen anybody die and their face changes? It goes to a smile.
I myself have not, but I have heard many, I've read many accounts of this, and several things occur. First of all, the first thing, which is very well known, and we didn't research it, but others have, is called deathbed visions. Many times somebody who's terminally ill, in the last few days of their life, will look up and they'll say mother or dad or name whoever it is, or just say, that's my brother. And they'll reach out and speak with that person, or sometimes describe a beautiful scenery that they're seeing, something like this, which seems to fill them with a great deal of peace and relaxation and hope. And now, that's been documented for decades. What we have is something we call bedside experiences, where a third party, could be a hospice nurse or counselor, somebody like that. It could be a hired nurse or staff person. It could be a family member. It doesn't matter who it is also present and also sees the one or more people who have come to help the dying patient make their transition.
Old Twilight Zone movie, Nothing in the Dark with Robert Redford. Remember that one?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
He was the police officer who really wanted to take an old woman up to heaven. And he had to do it by getting in her apartment, and she wouldn't let him in because she thought he was death. And she was petrified of him. Do they have those kinds of helpers who, like you say, the relatives who are there by bedside, but do they have helpers who literally take them by the spiritual hand and cross them over?
Apparently so, because we have a number of these bedside accounts, bedside experiences, where somebody saw, in some cases, just one person come. In other cases, there were so many people in that room, it was like, not I say people, they weren't in their physical body, they were in their spiritual body, but they saw an entire room filled with people surrounding the one who's dying. And in this case, the woman I'm thinking of, she was able to identify some of them from family photographs and say, I saw him or her and whatnot.
What about the person, now this is all speculation, but the person who dies in their sleep?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wonder what happens to them.
I think it's just a very easy transition.
But do you think they're met?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Why not?
Yeah.
You see, one of the things that has really changed me is this work, because I've been doing it for over 20 years now. I was raised Episcopalian, and I was taught, and I think most Christians believe, that some part of us, a soul or spirit, leaves our body when we die. And if we're very good, we go to heaven, and if we're not so good, for Catholic, we go to purgatory and limbo, and we go to that other hot place.
We can use that word here.
I know we can say hell on the radio today.
That we can.
A lot of other words, too.
As long as we use it for hell.
Right. And but I have a different way of describing it now, and this is my opinion. I'm not trying to impose it on anyone else, but it seems to explain a lot of things for me personally, and that is I view it that each of us right here, right now, you, I, everybody who's listening to us, each of us is a soul or a spirit who is wearing or inhabiting a physical body. Our physical body is our earth suit.
It's a shell.
It's a shell, but it's our earth suit. It's like what an astronaut would wear outside the space capsule in space. You have to have that to protect you and whatnot. Or the deep sea diver way down deep with a big helmet and all that.
Exactly.
We need that. We need this body in order to function. I couldn't hold a telephone or a book or do anything that nobody could hear me or see me. I'd be invisible, et cetera, if I didn't have a body. And so that's our earth suit. We need it to function at this level of reality. And that's what dies, whether it's decay or, with age breaks down, or whether it's damaged severely in an accident or warfare, something like that, or whether it's killed by murder or suicide, whatever. It's destroyed. It's no longer functional.
Let's talk about the soul leaving the body, Bill, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, how about some examples of the soul leaving the body?
Yes, these are very beautiful experiences, and the variations of it are astounding. But basically, it's with one or more people, sometimes it's a whole group of people who are present in a room. The patient may be awake or they may be in a coma. And all of a sudden, they will see almost like a puff of smoke is one way to describe it, or a bit of energy rising from the middle of the chest or coming out the top of the head, and then it forms into the lightness or the beingness, the spiritual beingness of the one who died. It may last and linger in the room. There may be one or two way communication from them, such as saying, thank you for taking care of me, or thank you for being with me, I love you, and goodbye. Mm-hmm. And typically they go up through the ceiling or out through the window. It's that simple. It's
and
just leaving something behind that's no longer required, their physical body, and off they go.
And, there's a scientist that has measured and weighed the body after death, and he claims the soul weighs a very minute amount of weight,
mm-hmm.
but he claims that it does have some mass to it.
Yes, I've heard that.
It's an incredible story.
It was a beautiful, very touching experience of this kind of, in a way, it's a very tragic story as well, of course, as you'll hear. But it was a mother and father, very young couple with a very young child in their arms, waiting to be seen in a waiting room of a very large hospital and public hospital. And this was a number of years ago, so hopefully the services are better now. But they were waiting, and the little child had a high temperature and didn't get seen. And finally, the child died.
Ugh.
And but fortunately for each of them, both of them, they both saw his soul leave his body independently. They saw it.
In a very strange way, that's got to be comforting for them.
It was very comforting to know that there's something more, and their son, the little boy, is moving on to another dimension, and will be there for them when they make their own transition.
Is there a way people can conjure up these experiences?
Conjure up?
That sounds like a witchcraft or something. To summon them up, I guess.
I mean, I guess people could fantasize it if they were on drugs or something like that, but we haven't come across anybody who was even trying to do these things.
So you can't just simply ask for this experience?
Not for seeing the soul leave the body, I don't think. You can ask to have an ADC, which I'll get to in a minute, because it's one more category of the at the time of death, and that's what we call an escort to the light. And that's where a party such as these are a small category, but nevertheless a significant one.
Okay, what is it?
Somebody will go into a meditative state or fall asleep, and they will actually escort the one who's died from over hill and dale, so to speak, to the light. It reads very much like a near-death experience. And as they go to the light, they see beings waiting for the one who's died, crossing over, and greeting that person. And they're told, thank you very much for coming and escorting the spirit, the soul. And you
go back
now. Go back now.
Why is that permissible?
I'm sorry, what?
Why is it permissible? Why did do they allow that to happen?
I think it's just to help the one to make their transition. And again, these are all bonds of love. And if you love somebody very much and you have the ability to do this, they're not very common. But we've heard a few of them. And this is what they do.
And the living person remembers this experience?
Yes. That's the one who narrates it and tells it to us.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And by the way, I should have said also that when someone is dying and there somebody who's able to see who has come to help that person, occasionally they'll see a religious figure such as Jesus or Mary or an angel or some being like that in the room as well. So there is a belief, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has said it, as others, is that nobody dies alone. And if you just can hold on to that when you're very bereaved and a loved one is dying, that nobody dies alone, that there'll be somebody there to assist him or her
make
their transition.
How are you able to weed out the what you believe to be the real experiences from those that might not be?
Just pure numbers. When you get so many numbers of descriptions that are so much alike, they seem to replicate each other almost. And then you get something way off on the side that just, it may sound great, but it's just too good or too something, too eccentric, too different. And it just doesn't fit the pattern. Now, maybe if we got three or four more of those, we might say it. We might open up our minds further. But by and large, these over, if people read Hello from Heaven within each chapter, we'll see that we move from the simple to the more complex experiences within the chapter and throughout the book over and over and over again. And you just get a feel of their authenticity.
And what's the main message you want people to grasp from Hello from Heaven?
Basically, that life continues. Life, it's not a matter of this side and that side. It's we are spirits. We are souls. We do continue. And that we were with our loved ones. We are with our loved ones, hopefully, here on Earth. And we will continue to be after we make our transition. That's one thing that's very important to me. And something else I discovered is language. This is going to sound a little bit intellectual, but it's very strange that because my father died when I was 8, and that's why I'm speaking now as a brief child for the moment.
Okay.
Let's go to the cemetery to visit your daddy. But daddy isn't there. His body is there.
That's right.
His body got buried. Daddy isn't buried. Daddy wasn't buried in the cemetery.
Daddy's gone.
Daddy's gone. I admit that. But I was told Daddy's in the cemetery, and I attended the funeral and watched the body being lowered to the grave, and somehow that was my daddy. Do you hear the difference?
Uh-huh.
And then we say, well, Grandma's going to be cremated. Well, if you know what that means, set on fire, burned to death. No, it's not Grandma. It's Grandma's body. And we do not differentiate, especially for children. I mean, you know, adults can, but children don't. They're very literal. And how frightening. Death is so frightening within our culture, is what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely.
And now, of course, it's good that it is, because we don't rush out into a street and we take war much more seriously and things like that. But at the same time, we don't have to frighten children with this archaic language that we have. And unfortunately, they did a show on suicide in HBO a couple of years ago. And they showed the same old stereotypes about suicide and the church's views on it and all the superstition and nonsense. And they didn't update anything. And they never came out and just said these are people, in many cases, who are really depressed or and things of that nature. This is not a choice they make. It's just that they feel overwhelming pain at that moment.
You don't like to use the word dead to describe these people who have died.
Because they're still alive. They're around us. And dead implies over, finished, complete, done. But we just say they make their transition. And they're still living and still loving. It's all about love. We live in a universe of love. That much I'm very convinced.
Have you come up with a theory on what this all is?
What's it all about?
What's it all about? Yeah.
What I've learned, and I didn't originate this, of course, I've just read a lot of books and heard a lot of people and very wise people. We've come here to learn how to love, to be more loving, to be more serving of one another, to be more kind and more considerate. I even made up a little thing for Christmas last year, and that is treat everyone with loving kindness, including yourself. And that loving kindness is actually that Buddhist phrase, loving kindness. Treat everyone with loving kindness, including yourself. We can all do that when we drive a car, when we were at work, when we're talking on the phone, when we're in a hurry. We can still open the door for somebody. We can smile at somebody. We're not talking about overwhelming, unconditional love for everybody, but just being kind, kinder to everybody.
And you know what? Also, to live each day as if it's your last.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you might as well enjoy this life.
Yes. That's the only one you have is this moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
You've researched, you've conducted thousands of interviews over these past 20-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the future hold for you, Bill?
We want to add these new chapters to Hello from Heaven and also revise the book, update it a bit. And I hope you received the CD I sent you.
Yes,
so we're together
sure
again.
The CD I have, and I have the book, and I have everything.
Can you play this on the air?
Not right now.
Okay.
But maybe later.
Okay.
Is there a specific?
This is a very special song that came to us from a woman who's right now just had pancreatic surgery for pancreatic cancer.
What cut? Which one do you want?
Yeah, well, there's only one. It's called Until We're. There's a vocal and there's an instrumental. So we're talking about the vocal version of Until We're Together Again.
Okay.
By Tiffany Colbert.
How long does it run?
It's about 4 minutes.
Okay.
4.5 minutes.
All right. We'll play a few minutes of it.
Okay. And it came through this woman who doesn't sing, doesn't play an instrument, doesn't write music, and it took 4 months for it to come through to her after she was contacted by her deceased brother-in-law. And she happens to live in the same town I do and contacted us. We've been friends for 3 years, and right now she's about to be released from the hospital following surgery on her pancreas, which was thought to be cancerous, but we believe through prayer she has been healed.
We got to do the same thing for Patrick Swayze. You know that?
All right. Definitely, definitely.
I mean, he's a great guy.
Oh, yes.
And haven't heard much about him lately. So I don't know if that's good news or bad news.
I don't know.
What is science doing about this? I mean, you've conducted your research.
There have been many, many books written on it. I think it's ironic. A much bigger field of research has been near-death experience, and that's been written about by many medical doctors, PhDs, all the people with all the right credentials. And yet the churches don't embrace these experiences. They don't share them. the places that be most likely to affirm life after death almost ignore all this material, and yet it is modern-day evidence for life after death, and they don't want to make a commitment or even bring it up as a discussion point.
Of these 12 contacts that people go through, is there one that's the most prevalent? You know, you talked about the, you know, hearing by telepathy. Is that the most? Or
the most common is feeling a presence, of course, and then probably what we call, people call a dream, although it's not a literal dream. It's a sleep state contact.
Yes.
And people have those very frequently simply because that's when we're the most open, passive, and receptive to having contact from a deceased loved one. And people will say this is totally unlike any ordinary dream because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's not symbolic. It doesn't swim. They don't have to try to write it down as soon as they wake up. It feels like an actual visit because it is a visit. And they remember it vividly 10, 20, 30 years later. So that's a very common type of experience. But the other thing we want to do in the book is have a chapter on how to have an ADC. I think you started to ask me that.
Right.
And the easiest ways is to learn how to meditate. And by that I mean meditation is nothing more than deep relaxation. You can do it with music. You can do it with CDs. You can do it with DVDs, whatever. You can just close your eyes and have special tapes that you can buy in ordinary bookstores or wherever for relaxing your mind and your body very, very deeply. This is how you open your intuitive senses.
It's about tuning yourself up, isn't it?
Yeah. It's increasing your vibratory rate or consciousness, whichever. And then, of course, another way is to ask. Ask your deceased loved one or Jesus or Mary or God or the universe or whoever, whatever you believe in. Please, I really want to hear from you. Please contact me while I'm awake or asleep. Let me know you still exist. You're okay. And a lot of people intuitively, regardless of their religious or non-religious beliefs, whatever their belief, they do ask for a sign. And many, many people do receive a sign. And it's never too late to do this. I mean, you don't have to do it in the first 3 months or 6 months. You can do it 10 years later. And the most common signs or symbols that people receive involve butterflies, which are the symbol for life after death, or rainbows. And it's not just having a rainbow, but having it occur on a special place and time and date, like an anniversary, birthday, things of this nature. And other people find pennies or dimes or feathers or whatever it may be, a gazillion different things. But you know who it's from, and it's usually a series of events that occur. And so ask for a sign. Asking is praying. Praying is asking, whoever you believe in. And also, as I say, ask to have contact while you're asleep or meditating or in prayer. And learn how to meditate, because that will enhance your life in general. If you learn how to meditate, you'll be able. Today, I think most Americans are suffering from stress. This is a wonderful way to reduce stress.
Sure. Now, you've interviewed people from Canada.
Yes.
The American states as well.
All 50 states, all 10 Canadian provinces.
Are other cultures in other countries, are they the same? Do they get more visitations,
we
less?
We think that they do, because they talk about them much more openly. There's more belief in these things in other countries.
Always were, right?
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Well, we don't realize that in a way, and I don't mean to step on anybody's toes, but our real religion in this country is science. And doctors and people like that are our high priests more than anything else. And we put so much faith in science and scientific application and technology, and we miss a lot that way. Science is wonderful for the physical universe, the physical level, but then there's the emotional, mental, and spiritual. And that's where we have to reach higher and go beyond science, which has many limitations to it. And trying to explain all emotionality and the spirituality in terms of science doesn't really work.
And you don't have to be a psychic. You don't have to be a medium to do this. You don't to have equipment to do this.
Nothing. It's just having an open mind and an open heart, I would say. And then the desire to help people, to help other people, to be caring. To be compassionate, to be forgiving, to be loving. And you'll have experiences for yourself. Matter of fact, I gave a workshop tonight. Here's a right here locally.
We've got you working all night then, don't we?
Yes, I did one at 7 o'clock our time. And it was a guided imagery. A woman in the group, a young woman, said, I have this overwhelming feeling I want to hug somebody, but I don't know who the hug is from. I just know that I need to hug somebody here in this room. And do I have permission to do that? And the other people said yes. And she walked directly over to one woman who about her own age and gave her a big hug. And that woman began bawling like a kid, saying, I was praying to my grandmother to receive a hug. I didn't need any words. I just needed to feel a hug.
There was a doctor in St. Louis, and that's what he did. He went up to people and hugged them all the time.
Mm-hmm. But this came through this one woman, and it was a message for another one. So sometimes you'll get a message for a neighbor or a friend or a business associate, and people say, well, if I tell them this, they're going to think I'm nuts or crazy. And I just say, just tell them you had a crazy dream. And if you call it a dream, you disarm them, and you can say whatever you want, whatever you got, and explain it to them as a dream, and they'll accept it. So,
what's the percentage, Bill, where the person is visited, he's healthy, nothing's going to happen to them, he's visited, compared to someone who's sickly, maybe about to die, they get visited? Is it about the same?
I would suspect that those who are close to death and their own are having many more visits from their deceased loved
ones
who are there to comfort them and let them know that they'll be there for them. Yes.
What about the old phone rings? It's the dead person.
Yes, we have a chapter on telephone ADCs. If you're asleep, some people can't accept the idea of seeing the deceased loved one in a dream, but they can accept a telephone call. But what happens if you're in your kitchen wide awake and the phone rings and you pick it up and you hear the voice of your father or grandparent or whoever it may be? And yet we have a whole chapter of people who had one-way or two-way communication with that deceased loved one.
Have they talked about what the caller ID shows? I've gotten weird calls on that. It shows like all ones or all X's.
Really?
It's weird.
No, that I hadn't heard, but I have heard that people are getting, since we wrote a book, there are more and more messages on computer screens, messages on telephone answering machines, recording machines, numbers on pagers. In other words, it seems to be that those on the other side are able to manipulate electricity and electrical products rather readily.
Soon they will learn how to text.
There you go.
That's the new mode. Stay with us, Bill. We're going to take phone calls next hour. Questions for you, and also stories, perhaps, if you want to share your story about an after-death communication. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Some of your calls, you might get another book out of this night, Bill.
Yes, indeed.
Let's go to some of the callers, and right before we do, has any of this changed your life, this work you've done?
Oh, it's transformed me immensely. As I told you earlier, I used to be very materialistic, agnostic. I now view myself very much as being spiritual. And for me, please understand my meaning of the word. I consider this my ministry. Now, by that, I don't mean I'm a minister in the capital letter use, but rather your radio show is your ministry.
Sure.
Other people's ministries, to drive a taxi or to be a waitress, to be a doctor, whatever it may be, a writer, a nurse, or whoever. And when we find, I think it was A Purpose-Driven Life and books like that, finding that which fulfills us, our purpose, our joy, our whole life changes. And I just hope everybody can have that opportunity.
Okay, now we're set the stage one more time about this CD. I'm going to play a little bit of it right here. Tell us about it.
Okay, this is a song that came through a young woman named Kathy Cochran, who was about 33 years old. Her brother-in-law had died, and she was the only one who really had an ongoing contact with him for a variety of reasons. First of all, he came to say, want you to wish me a happy birthday. And he had been a bit of a black sheep, that's as far as I want to go, during his lifetime. And she was the one that he trusted, and she asked her to wish me a happy birthday. And even in her sleep, she knew this wasn't her birthday because he was a twin brother of her husband, and the husband's their birthdays were 6 months later. And he said, in effect, no, I have a new birthday now here on the other side, and it's my new birthday, and that's why I want you to, my life is transformed, that's why I want you to wish me a happy birthday. And when she woke up and told her husband and his parents and everything the next day, everybody was very, very happy for him and for her as well. And then she began receiving music, and this is the most poignant song that I've heard, because there are many songs written to the one who died or about the one who died. Eric Clapton, for instance, wrote a song to his, about his son who died and whatnot. But this is the first song that I know of from the one who died to us who are still in the physical form. Okay. Until we're together again. Until we are together again. And you can people can order it from her website, which is Spirit.
And she vocalized it?
No, she does. We had it recorded professionally.
No, she did. Okay.
By a woman named Tiffany Colburn,
right,
who sings at Epcot.
Tell me, too, I've been getting some emails. For example, a person said that her mother died on her birthday. Is there a significance with that?
Whatever the person attaches to it. That's too big a question for me to answer.
Okay. Well, it could be just one of those things.
One of those. I try not to be judgmental about experiences and or read meaning into them. I say, please go deeper yourself. It's not, well, why, I'm not an expert to that degree, nor is anyone else.
To the phones we go. We go to Montebello, Virginia. Chris, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Chris.
Hi, George.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening for quite a few years.
Well, thanks for listening, and you're on.
Thank you for all the work you do. And I'm really excited to talk to Bill, because I actually met Bill when he was researching the book, and I'm one of the stories that's in the book.
Oh, you are? Super. Yes. Bill, how about
Hello
that?
Hello again. Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Hi there.
It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Yeah, I met you about 20 years ago at a... I think it was a conference on paranormal experiences, and you were wearing a name tag that said, have you ever had talked to anybody after death? And I told you my story, and then later I was interviewed by one of your callers.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the book came out, I was excited to see that the story was in the book. And it was and still is the most life transforming experience that I ever had. It was a friend of mine. I was 19 at the time. I'm 57 now, so it's been a long time. And he died in a car accident. I didn't know that he had died. The night that he did die, he appeared to me in my sleep state, but it was unlike any dream I've ever had. When I woke up in the morning, I thought it had been a dream, but I also knew it was a very different experience. And in the dream, he appeared to me. He was very much at ease and very happy. He was radiant. There was actually light around him. And he spoke to me very lovingly. We had just been very close friends in life. We both had a lot of questions about our religious upbringings and had a lot of angst in our life, and we were sort of each other's confidant. So in this experience that I had with him, he just glowed with this radiance, and he said, everything that we've talked about, he said, I understand it all now. It all makes sense. And he was so happy, and he told me how much he loved me, and he told me he understood my love for him. So that was nothing we'd ever really talked about a whole lot, but he did express it in this experience. And the most important thing he said to me was that no matter what happens, you have to go on because you are on the right path. And that was the experience. And then he just sort of disappeared. And I woke up the next morning, and I was I remembered every single detail of this dream explicitly, and I still do to this day. And my feeling was, I was a 19-year-old girl, and I was like, I had never felt any kind of love like that ever in my whole life. And I, at the time, just thought, oh, my gosh, I love this man. We're going to spend the rest of our lives together. And I was in college at the time. Yeah. I went on to my classes, and on the way home, a friend of mine was driving me home, and I started sobbing. I just started, I had this overwhelming feeling something horrible had happened. Mm-hmm. And when I got home that night, I was fixing dinner, and I turned on the news, and I heard on the news that my friend had died in a car accident the night before. So he had actually died probably around the time that he appeared to me.
You felt it. You saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, at the time, devastating because I didn't understand. It was such a shock. I was a young person. I really didn't know what to do with what had happened.
You don't even think of the communication at that point, do you? You just
think about the tragedy. No, and then I was haunted by this dream, as like this experience. Is what does this mean? What does this mean? And it took a few years, and I actually later took a class from a woman who had studied with Dr. Kubler-Ross, and it helped me to resolve a lot of the unclear feelings I had. But it set my whole life on a path that I never would have gone on. I became very interested in spirituality, in all kinds of religion. I'm a meditator. My whole life is still affected daily by that experience. And a few times I've had some serious health problems. I've come close to death. And always Pete's voice has been there saying, no matter what happens, you have to go on because you're on the right path. And it's been this incredible life transforming experience for me.
Would you look forward to another dream like that if it ever came?
Well, this is what's interesting. I've had many more since then.
That about him or other people?
For a while, he appeared at times, but it opened me to the experience of others being able to contact me when they had just passed. And I've had numerous experiences now. Some were close friends, some were relatives, and one was even a woman that was in the hospital with me when I was hospitalized one time. She later went to a nursing home. I lost touch with her. And all of a sudden, like years later, her name and her face was right, her presence was there. And I opened up the newspaper that day and saw her obituary.
Jeez.
So she was contacting me, I believe, in that way.
All right. Well, thank you for the story, Chris.
Thank you, George. It's been great talking to you. And thank you, Bill, for the work you're doing. And keep it up.
A beautiful story, and what I really heard, I hadn't said it earlier, I want to emphasize that when we do see a deceased loved one, when we're awake or in a sleep state, 99.99% of the time, they appear healed and whole in radiant health, regardless of their cause of death. I say it could be a horrible fire, car accident, explosion, battlefield, death, I don't have to go into details. Whatever it is, they come back healed and whole and radiant health, radiating that. Whether they say anything or not, you can still see that. And that's a beautiful final picture, especially for a mother or a wife to see of her husband or
absolutely
son or
some whoever, people, maybe. Bill, who dream of those who are alive will tell a story to that person, that living person, and they'll panic. That living person will think, oh, my God, you had a dream of me. That means I'm going to die. I've seen this happen a lot. Why do they panic so much?
I think it's superstition and folklore and things like that. It's back to the boogeyman and the stuff that we were taught as children.
I saw you holding a flower, and they panic.
It's just old stuff because we're not trained in any of this. This is like, all of a sudden there's a book called Hello from Heaven that comes out of nowhere describing ordinary experiences by ordinary people, but it doesn't have a setting to fit into previously, you see.
Yeah.
And it's like, where did that come from? How about, yes, I've had experiences like this. Wow, I'm so glad that somebody has written a book to validate them. And that's what so many people told us when we interviewed them. Thank you for listening to me. I told two or three people who believed me, but the rest I could tell were skeptical. And it's such a relief to be able to tell somebody and have them listen to me and believe me.
Let's go to Hartford, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Rex. You're up with us.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Hey, first of all, that was a very beautiful song that I heard, and I certainly hope there'll be a way to download that here soon.
You can buy the CD, I guess.
Okay, that's fine. Well, the reason I'm calling, I actually didn't intend on calling tonight, but the reason I'm calling was your guest Bill had mentioned what he defined was the soul, and that the soul possesses, if you will, the organic body. You there?
Yeah, we're listening.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and one thing I don't hear from Bill, and maybe he's never looked into it, was I personally am a life before birth experience.
You're a life before birth experience. Explain that.
That means I have awareness before I entered the human body. I remember my life before I was born.
Now, were you already embryonic at the time?
No, this was well before that.
Spirit.
I was in heaven.
Interesting. Interesting indeed. What do you remember? What do you know? Did you pick the family you ultimately grew up with?
Well, I'm not sure of my circumstances other than it seems to me where I was what you would call in an observation room looking down upon the earth.
Uh-huh.
And due to whatever circumstances, I would have to say my memory was either fogged or erased because I was not allowed to bring knowledge from heaven into the observation room. But I can remember who I was. I was just a ball of energy, if you will. I did not have a body. I did not have arms, legs, whatever it may be. I can remember. I did not need to breathe. So when I come here to Earth, I have asthma, and so, you know, it's
I'm laughing with you, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
sure.
Like, you know, I can remember. I didn't have to deal with this. You know, there was no time, no space. And
life's tough, Rex.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm interested in hearing Bill's interpretation and or if he's thought about and or looked into life before birth.
Let's get your thoughts on that.
Okay, I'd be very happy to answer that. This is not part of our own personal research or our book, but I'm going to recommend two wonderful books to you that are very well written, very clear,
yep.
And they're about what is known the interlife. That's the life between lives. One title is Journey of Souls, Journey of Souls,
mm-hmm.
And the other is Destiny of Souls, Destiny of Souls, by a man named Michael Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, like a fig Newton. Michael Newton, Ph.D., and he has a third book coming out as well. And this is about our life between lives and how we choose many of the circumstances of our current physical life.
Okay, very good.
That's
thanks,
not part
Rex.
Of Hello from Heaven. It's just something I also have read about and believe in myself, and I don't want to go too far with that.
Well, where do you get Hello from Heaven?
Amazon.com or any large bookstores. Barnes & Noble, Borders, et cetera, or any bookstore can order it for you if they don't have it in stock.
It's out in paperback.
It's a paperback for $7.99 in the United States.
Can't beat that.
And it's by the way, we're very proud. It's going to be published in Chinese.
Good for you.
And in Russian. And just recently it's come out in Spanish, in Spain, and in Portuguese, in Brazil. And it's in over a dozen languages now, including Polish and some other unusual languages. And it's wonderful because it's not about me. It's not about our work. And we view ourselves almost as representatives of the work because it's everybody else's experiences, and we're just sharing it with the world. And that's how we see ourselves.
Well, and it's nice, though, Bill, to get acknowledged for the kind of
that's,
work.
That's nice, too, but that's secondary. By the way, I would like to mention our website, www.after-death.com. because we've had over 2.5 million visitors to that. And anybody who wants to learn more about this topic, and it's also a way to be connected to the links where you could order the song, hear the song, and order the song you just played until we're together again. And people can write to us, send us emails.
Okay, we're going to come back with more of your phone calls, more of your stories. And then next hour, Bill will stick with us for more of the same. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Ed Guggenheim, Hello from Heaven, and your phone calls. And let's go back for more. Colorado City we go in Colorado. Hello, Tanya, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to share my experience with my dog, Norman, with both of you, and also for...
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and we're going to call you back, Tanya. You've got a bad connection, but I know you've been holding for a long time. So, Tom, let's get back to Tanya and see if you can get a better connection. I don't want her to have to go through the system again. It'll be 8 years, Bill, before she gets back on. Let's go to Johnson City, Tennessee. First-time caller. Hello, Bobby. It's your turn.
Hello, George. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Hello. I was on the live chat earlier with George, and I told him to send him a message about my 3-year-old daughter.
Yeah, that's you. Okay.
Yeah. She tells my wife that she used to take care of her when she was little, and she can tell my wife that she used to push her on a swing set and how many dogs they had, what color they were, you know, where they used to live. She also talks about speaking to Fred, and Fred is my great-grandfather. There's no way that she's ever met these people. I was just wondering what either your opinions are on that and whether she may be receiving communications from these people, or she's talking about maybe a past life where she's been reincarnated. But she says these kinds of things, you know, really often. And I was just wondering, you know, what you thought about it.
Okay. Once again, this is not part of our personal research for Hello from Heaven or After Death Communications, but this, from what you've said so far, sounds very much like a past life recall.
Yeah, incredible story.
And there is a book called 15 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation by a man named Ian Stevenson. Ian Stevenson, mm-hmm. When he was at the University of Virginia, he went to India and he interviewed very young children who had memories of other lives and were able to go from the village they lived in and direct people to another village at some distance, and were able to describe in detail where certain buildings were, who certain people were, and all kinds of details about that prior life of theirs.
Well,
so it's not something that's really part of our Western civilization, but in other parts of the world, it's just commonplace belief.
Okay.
Okay, very, very good. Let's go to Jennifer, Montgomery, Alabama, and you're up. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello, George. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Been trying a long time. It's been a while. My mother passed away 21 years ago, and I could never dream about her. I wanted to so bad, and I begged and begged and begged. All of my dreams have always been in black and white, never color, until a few years ago. She finally came to me, and she came to me in the most vivid, most beautiful color in the whole wide world. All right, if you're in your car and you're real in a hot city and you're like driving and you look at the hood of your car and like the heat is rising above, okay, that's how glowing all of the color was in my dream when my mother came to me.
It's like that movie, What Dreams May Come. Color all over the place.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I've never seen that
Oh,
movie.
You've got to see that.
No. These are dreams about dead people in my family, and only dead in color. Everything else is black and white. Then my fiancé, 2.5 years ago, died in a plane crash. It was not his fault. He was brilliant, a professor.
Was he pilot? Was he the pilot?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, a And it was a horrible runway. I Googled it, and it was small, one runway, and they had not cut down the trees.
Oh.
And the trees were 130 feet tall, and the indicator light at the end of the runway where you come into land was not on, and it was night.
He'd never landed
there before.
Oh.
Yes, and they had reported it to the FAA. And then, yeah, and nobody did anything about it. Nothing happened, but when they found out, they climbed the tree, and they ended up cutting the trees down, but they
got
the indicator light, and it was blown out. The fuse was blown out, everything. So none of it was his fault. None of it at all.
Sad.
So I grieved. I grieved, and I begged for him to come to me. And I grieved for 2.5 years, and I almost died of pure grief. And it happens. And I begged him to come to me. He started coming to me through the television, turning it on and off. He was a mechanical engineer and an environmental engineer, and also through my stereo. And also, whenever I got on my computer, he shut it on and off with printer. And he came to me in a dream. And my mother and my grandmother, who are deceased, were standing at the top of a driveway at our old house. And he came to me in a gorgeous red glowing airplane. He got out of the airplane, and somebody else was in there with him, a guy. And it looked like him. And I know that he had, like, his former wife had, you know, lost babies. So I wondered if that was a son of his, you know. But I looked at him, and everything was so colorful, so glowing. And he looked at me, and he said, "Jennifer," he said, "you can't come with me now. You cannot come," because I kept telling him, "I want to come with you."
Yeah.
And he said, he put his hands on my shoulders. He said, "It's not time for you to come with me." He said, "But when it is time, will you promise me that when I come to get you, you'll come with me?" And I said, "Yes." And we smiled at each other, and he backed off, and he got in the airplane with the guy, and they flew away. And it was the most wonderful dream I've ever had. Wonderful.
That's a great
beautiful
story.
Beautiful. And then
that helped you too,
then,
didn't it?
Yes, it did. And it did for a while, but then I started grieving again, and I decided to go to a hypnotist. And this is very helpful for people, because the hypnotist told me that I was only allowed to grieve just a little bit every day. And then I was to take my two fingers and slap my wrist 3 times and say, "No more today." So I did that, started doing it, felt great after a few weeks, and I talked to him just, you know, in my bedroom. I talked to Tim, and I told him, I said, "Tim, you've got to quit turning my TV on and off, my stereo, my printer. You've got to stop it.
My electric bill's going through the roof, right?"
Yeah, you've got to. You've got to go to the light. You've got to go. You're caught in some dimension. You've got to go away. You've got to go away. And I want you to know he stopped. He has not come back. And that's been a couple. I've been seeing a hypnotist about 2 months.
Let me ask you this story.
Fantastic.
Oh, the hypnotherapists are just dynamite. Bill, in these cases, the cases for Hello from Heaven, these visitations. The dead person, the spirit, has already moved on, but they come back, right?
Briefly, yes.
Briefly.
We hope. I mean, there may be some that are earthbound.
Or have they not gone to the light yet?
No, we believe that they have gone to the light, and they're allowed. This is in some of the languaging, even, that they've been either allowed to come back for a brief while for a visit, or they've been, actually, some people believe they've been sent by God back for a visit. But that's and also there's often language, I have to go now, I have to leave now, like, meaning it's I can only visit for a short time. So it's we're not dealing with, hopefully, with earthbound souls who are just hanging out forever. No.
Okay, next up we go to Ben.
That's a very beautiful story.
I want to
comment to that. And how he's, remember what I said earlier, that they will be there for us when we make our own transition?
Uh-huh.
That's what he was assuring her of.
These dreams, too, seem powerful. In the visitations, is it primarily dreams?
No. That's just one of the,
one of the 12.
One of the largest categories, because that's when we're most open and receptive. So I like to say to people, you know, try to get through to people in an ordinary way. You make a phone call, you get an answer machine. You know, you page them, you send emails, and on and on and on. We're so hard, so busy to get hold of. But at least when we're asleep, we're in one, hopefully in one place. And that's when they can come more readily. Then or when we're meditating or something like that.
All right. Thanks, Jennifer. Let's now go to Kirk in Bend, Oregon. Hey, Kirk.
Good evening, George. Good evening, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
I lost my father in 1992. He died of cancer. And it was one of those things where they send you home and you're going to die at home. It's kind of a hospice thing. And no one was around one morning. My mother gave me a call. So I showed up. And she said father had fallen on the floor. And I came in the house and helped him back in a chair, and when I looked above the living room ceiling, there was, like, there was no ceiling in the living room where he was, but there was one, I want to say angel, but I just want to say a spirit guide or someone was there with their legs crossed, just sort of biding their time. And my mother asked me, what do you think? And I said, I think today's the day. You know, I told her I saw an angel sitting out there, and we came out of another office room back into the room to check on Dad. And sure enough, there was another one there. And it took around 12, 14 hours for him to die.
Did your mother see this too?
No.
Just you?
She didn't say a whole bunch.
How about Dad? Did he see anything?
He was kind of in and out of consciousness.
In and out. Okay. Okay.
But during the day, they kept showing up in greater and greater numbers. And I heard Bill tell a story where the room was full of spirits. And they'd all come to help someone through. And that's all I can make of it. And my sister-in-law, who's been a nurse for about 30 years, she was the attending nurse there to see over everything. And she said, you know, when your father passes away, you'll see his eyes dilate. And I would say there was 25, 30 angels. They were all conversing with each other in groups all around us in this room. And just one of the most strangest things. And as soon as he did pass away, she said, say goodbye to him. This is your moment. Right now he's in the room with you. And we did, and the roof of the house just came back, and everyone was gone above me. And it was, instead of feeling sad, I felt more joy than anything, you know, because of his illness. It sort of took the weight off me. And I wasn't a real spiritual person before then. I was young and doing my own thing. That sort of gave me, I guess, more belief in the afterlife. And then 2 years ago, I lost my sister of leukemia. And around 2 months after I lost her, I was with her in the hospital. I was the last one to show up. I had to fly to California to see her. And about 2 months later, I was back in up here in the Portland area. And she came to visit me one night, woke me up, sat down on a couch where I fell asleep. And I felt the couch move. And when I looked down toward my feet, she was sitting on the end of the couch. And she wasn't really glowing, but she was right there. And she just touched my feet and told me, everything's going to be okay. I'm with Dad now. And when it's your time, I'll see you again. And it's going to be okay. We'll help you through it. And I said, okay. And she said what another caller had said. She told me, I can't stick around long. I got to go. And then I just closed my eyes and just dealt with it on that level. And that was about the end of that. But now I have just a stronger belief. And this show tonight, is I'm a first-time caller. I got through the first time I dialed. I couldn't believe it.
There you go.
I prayed to for my sister, who I think is my spirit guide. She's always there to guide me still. And I prayed. I said, you know, just help me through this, teen. Just help me through this. Help me get through. First time I dialed, I got through.
There you go.
Unbelievable. I've been listening since 92 or so, and I don't go to sleep without this show.
Thanks, Kurt. Thanks for supporting us. It's a great story there, too, Bill.
George, you see, just by just opening up your phone lines, you're getting hello from heaven on the air.
Yeah, absolutely.
Story after story.
Absolutely. The visitations, The after-death communications. Who's it for, the living or the dead?
Oh, it's very much for the living. They're coming to reassure us. Just as I've been saying throughout the evening, that they're assuring us they still continue to exist. Some will actually come out and say, don't worry about me, don't grieve for me. Everything will be all right. And the big message is go on with your life. Talking now more about the former woman who is very, very bereaved. They want us to go on with our life. We're here for a reason. We're meant to learn a lot. And don't allow our grief to so choke us up and make us bitter or grief-stricken or whatever that we cease living. Because in some cases, by the way, if a husband or a wife dies, the one who made their transition comes back and gives permission for the living one to remarry.
Yeah, yeah, like and they need that.
Yes, some people do need that. And sometimes people are told, I'll always be there for you, and I'm watching over you. And very much like a guardian angel type relationship.
The person who didn't have a good life, the person who may have been a murderer, somebody evil, they die. Their spirit, what happens to that? Do they still come back and communicate with people?
I don't know about something that drastic. I'll tell you an anecdote in a moment. But there is an experience in our book where a woman had been molested by, I think, an uncle, and he was an alcoholic. And she had an experience where not only he came, but she saw Jesus with him. So he was escorted. And it's a very beautiful account. I don't remember all the details, but basically Jesus was saying, do you hold anything against this man? And she said, no, this was a number of years later. And he said, neither do I. And so there is redemption, so to speak, on the other side as well.
Interesting.
Now, as far as somebody going much deeper than that into murder and whatnot, I don't know, but you may. There was that serial murderer here in Florida, Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy, yes.
I don't want to go into a lot of this. We did not interview the woman. I merely spoke to her on the phone, and that was enough to show me. But for some reason, and we hear about people, women especially, who want to write to convicts and have relationships with people in prisons and whatever, she decided that she wanted to have contact with George Bundy after he was executed.
Yeah.
And she went into a meditative state, and as she was there, she began feeling, and this is her language, a mountain of slime starting to move towards her.
Ugh.
And that's enough language right there.
Yeah.
And that's where I tuned out. But she aborted her meditation. She got out of it fast. But let's not try to communicate with the lower levels or people who have been very disturbed.
It's not very enlightening, Bill.
I don't get anything positive out of it, no.
Would you give us your website again?
It's www.after-hyphen, that's between the two words, after-death.com.
And the words from that CD came from a spirit for that lady?
Or was no, they just came. I don't think she knows the exact source of the words, but she was inspired to begin receiving music, and this is one of the songs she received. And I'm very excited because when she is fully well again, and she's going home tomorrow to live at her parents' home for a while before she moves back in her own home, when she's fully restored to good health, we want to record this song by a children's choir.
Oh, that would be cool. Hey, Bill, stay with us. We've got one more final hour phone calls and questions for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight is doing just a marvelous job, Bill Guggenheim. Hello from heaven. And welcome back. We're with Bill Guggenheim. We're going to take your final phone calls this hour. Fast night, Bill, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Really
wonderful
keeps
night.
Rolling by. And by the way, thank you for the signed copy of the book. It was very nice.
Delighted to send it to you, George.
Okay, let's go back to more calls. Here we go. This is going to take off like a rocket. Houston, Texas. Hey, Fred, take it away.
Hello. I was laying on my bed in my bedroom, and I had a number of flight attendant friends that were not there, and a lady appeared in front of me. She kind of came in a bubble, and she looked like she was about 18 years old, and she had long black hair. And she was wearing, it looked like a buckskin dress that had fringe along the bottom of it. And she had a line of blue turquoise beads along the bodice. And she said, tell Kay I'm okay. And so I picked up the telephone, and I called one of my flight attendant friends, who was named Kay, and I said, Kay, do you know a lady who has a dress like this? And she said, no, I don't. Well, she said to tell you that she's okay. And Kay just froze on the phone, and she said, oh, my God. The lady that raised me, she had a daughter my age, and the lady that raised me, who is 75 or was 75, was hit by a train yesterday. And that was her favorite dress.
Oh, so she remembered the dress.
She remembered the dress, even though her hair was different, and the lady looked like she was about 17 or 18. And, and the lady said, thank you so much, and just tell her I'm okay. And I said, hey, she just said to say that she was okay, and the lady just disappeared.
I love it. Bill, why do they come back in different ages or moments where they look?
What we understand is that people, if they choose to, can go back towards the prime of their life.
A happy moment as well?
In other words, would you rather be a 90-year-old man filled with a tumor from cancer the size of a basketball, or would you like to be, like, say, 22 again?
Let me think about that.
Or vice versa, for a woman.
Reminds me of the old Jack Benny joke where someone came up behind him with a gun and said, your money or your life, and he went, let me think about that.
Yeah, that was the longest pause in radio.
Yeah, exactly. Next up, we go to Kansas City, Kansas. First-time caller, Jody, you're on with Bill Guggenheim. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. I've been listening to you for a long time.
Well, thank you, Jody.
And hi, Mr. Bill.
Hi.
Everything you've been saying is true. I've lost, I lost a little one before he was born. Well, when he was born, he was still born, and I've lost other kids. And one day, Mother's Day was real hard. Well, he came out of nowhere. He came down, and this young man came beside me in a cart and said, Happy Mother's Day, Mom. And poof, he was gone. And the person I was with, I had him go look for him because I was just going to say, thank you, you made my night, made my day. Well, he just disappeared. No one had ever seen him. And ever since then, Mother's Day seems a lot easier for me. And whenever I'm frightened or scared or something's really tough, he'll play with the lights and let me know that he's my guardian angel. And he's saying, I'm here, Mom.
Everything's okay.
And I talk to him, and they tell me don't talk to him. But I guess when I get up there, he kind of laughs and says, boy, you're going to be there. But, yes, thank you so much. You've made my night.
Thank you, Julie.
Who tells you not to talk to your child?
People. They say, don't talk to him. They're at rest. No.
He's more alive than you or I are. Mm-hmm. And you can talk to him and send him love and good feelings anytime you want.
Oh, I do. And things are going wrong. I go, well, I know. But I said, you're my dad. I was very close to my dad, and I feel them both, and I talk to them both.
Fine.
And I feel them both by me, and I still do, and thank you for telling me I came.
Okay.
Well, I mean, what would heaven be like if everybody's at rest?
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody be asleep? What? What's going on?
What do you recommend parents do to little kids who say they see these entities? They talk to these entities. So many parents, I think, don't encourage it, Bill, for whatever reason. They think, the kid will grow out of it. What should they do?
Ideally, they'd be open enough to listen and ask open-ended questions and see what they learn, because that's what this chapter about children's after-death communication experiences will be about in our book. These are parents that were willing to listen, because blowing them off is just telling the child that what they're experiencing is not real. And you keep doing this in life, and their world gets smaller and smaller and smaller. It's just like saying to a kid, don't even try playing a sport because you're going to fail. Don't do this, don't do that.
Children grow out of this?
In our culture, they tend to, yes. Nobody wants to be different. I mean, look at the conformity in high school, junior high school, and all the rest of it. Terms of clothing and everything else, and nobody wants to be weird or different or see things that other people don't see or hear things that other people don't hear. And the belief is that we come in with a great deal of spiritual knowledge and awareness and sometimes memories of past lives. But unless we have a family that encourages us to talk about these things and think about them, it's sort of drummed out of us.
Okay, we go to Burbank, California. Hey, Ed, go ahead.
I will concur with many of the other people. My mother was born with a veil on her face, and so she had a couple of visitations when she was 8 years old.
Yeah.
She was in New York, 8 years old, with her mother, and her mother had just lost her mother and was washing dishes, and she hears a knocking on her apartment door. Well, she thought it was these kids from downstairs. She said, go away, and she's busy crying and all, and she still hears a little knock, and she says, I said, go away, and knock wouldn't stop, so she opened the door with the little chain on it, and she turned around, and my mother says, oh, look, Grandma's here. And her mother says, what are you talking about? And she looked, and her mother was right there. And she says, oh, let me go get the rest of the relatives. You passed away or something, but you're here. And she says, no, if you do that, I won't be here anymore. So she saw that as 8 years old. And then as she got older and was going to marry my father, she went to visit his mother in a different part of the country, and she couldn't sleep one night, and she went into the living room of the house she was staying at, and she saw a man sitting in a rocking chair there, and she just shook her head and ran back upstairs, says, there's a guy downstairs in the rocking chair. She explained it to, they said, what was he wearing, and she explained it, and turns out it was his dead father. And when they said, well, what was he wearing? She said everything that had like a striped suit and a boutonniere, a little flower there. And they pulled out a picture, and that's exactly what he was wearing in the picture.
There you go.
But, yeah, that happens. I was going to ask George, too, if he's familiar with a show called The Tales from the Dark Side.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you remember the episode where the grandfather shows up at this family's house, and he had passed away, and they're saying, Dad, you're dead. What are you doing here? He says, I'm not dead. I'm right here.
Here I am.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That show?
Yeah.
When that happened? And he was visiting?
Long time ago.
Okay. So that was like a visitation they were having, and they couldn't get rid of him because the smell kept getting worse and everything.
He didn't want to leave.
Right, because he didn't think he was dead. So finally, as the smell got worse, and they said, we can't, how would we get rid of him? Well, the little boy one day put pepper into the napkin, and as they were eating and the guy was wiping his nose, he sneezed. And you just see him put the napkin down and said, it's time for me to go now.
That did it.
Yeah, and they said, like, well, everybody's wondering, why is he going now? And then they do a close-up of the napkin, and you see his nose in it. And then he realizes
he was dead.
Now, I do have
not the way Bill would call it.
Never heard anything like that.
That's right.
It's interesting. But I do have a question for your guest, too.
Sure.
When we talk about these people that we see in cemeteries, you might see ghosts remaining there walking or whatever. Why don't we hear about the ghosts on bridges that many of them, many people who have taken their life by jumping off the bridges? Why don't we hear people say, oh, I see loads of people standing there? Because I've been to different towns that they say, oh, about 100 people jumped off that bridge. But you never hear people saying...
Sometimes they hang around, but I don't know if ghosts are your area of expertise, Bill.
No, they're not. Not at all. I mean, obviously, people have jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge and whatnot, and those certainly aren't happy circumstances, and I don't think the people who died that way exactly want to revisit that.
Do you find that most of the visitations are done by spirits who have just died naturally?
No. No, certainly many have died in warfare. They come back. Others in car crashes, plane crashes, murder, suicide. No, awful. The form of death doesn't really matter.
Let's go to Beverly Hills, California. Hey, Susan, go ahead.
Hi. I love the show.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My story's a little different. Mine is about an animal that came back to me. I had a cat that was with me. I rescued her, and she was with me for 15 years. And she was all I had. My family is all gone. My husband died. I'm a widow. And all my friends are all gone. And she was my baby. And she was different from most cats. She was so loving and so mellow. And she made me laugh every day.
Sure.
I had gotten her. I had been in a deep depression. And she made me laugh.
How old was she when you got her?
I think that when I rescued her, the foundation said she was maybe two.
So 17 years, that's pretty good for a cat, isn't it, Susan?
Well, the vet said maybe she was five.
Yeah.
So she was an old girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said that maybe in human years, when she finally died, that she was maybe 99.
How soon did she come back after she died?
Well, I was grieving. I was so torn up. I was crying every day. And I was miserable, and I was inconsolable, and crying. And I had taken to burning these big, wide beeswax candles and just playing music and reading, laying down on the top of the bed and reading. And one night I happened to walk past one of the candles, and it was emitting so much warmth. I just got the feeling that she was around, that she was maybe there. And I thought, well, okay, that's good. And then one night I was laying on top of the bed just reading, and the music was playing and the candles were burning. And I felt the bed kind of shudder, and suddenly she jumped up on the bed. And it was her. It was Miranda. And I said, Miranda, you're here. And she just paused on the end of the bed and looked at me. And I was looking at her, and she was really there. And she just sort of walked up the bed and laid down beside me and put her head down next to my leg and purred gently. And I started to smile again.
Does she still keep coming back, Susan?
No, it was just the one time.
Just enough to get you
just to
back.
Make me smile.
Yeah.
And she laid there next to me, and I went back to reading, and I read maybe one sentence. And I looked up again, and she was gone. But I was still smiling.
Yeah.
And
sounds like you're still smiling.
Yeah, and the grief was gone. It dissipated. It was the next day I called a friend, and I said, you know what, I'm ready for that pitter-patter of four paws again. Let's go rescue another cat.
Good for you.
And we went to the shelter the next day, and I got myself a new cat. I rescued a new cat, a boy cat. He's a whole different kind of animal. And he's abused, and he takes all kinds of patience and nurturing and everything, and he's a whole new experience.
In a strange way, though, she rescued you.
Right.
After you rescued her.
She was really there. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it. You know, she was really there. But then she was gone. You know, she was there for a couple of minutes, and I saw her with my own eyes. I blinked very hard, and she was really there. And I didn't tell a lot of people. I feel like I'm just telling you right now.
Well, yeah, and a few other people.
Yeah. I guess so, but it wasn't something I told a lot of people about either, you know. I just sort of, she rescued me that night.
Yeah, that's a great story, Susan.
Yeah, I just, you know, I heard you at the top of the show say something about a horse. And I thought, wow, that's right. Miranda came back to me. That's right, she did.
It happens, Bill. Thanks,
yes,
Susan.
It does. By the way, there's a beautiful website. I can't remember the exact name of it right now, but if somebody goes and Googles like pet loss and brings up, this is something like Animal Bridge, and they have a beautiful poem and a song for bereaved pet owners.
You know what I find to be a common denominator here, and that's these spirits, these souls, these entities, whatever you want to call them, all seem to want you as a human being to be happy.
Yes, yes.
And that I find to be remarkable.
Which comes back to the word I was using earlier. It's all about love.
Yeah.
They care about us. They love us. They want us to go on with our life, to be as happy as we can, not to grieve for them. And it's their way of caring and communicating with us to let us know they're okay. We don't have to worry about them.
They give you the comfort, the emotional support, as you write about.
That's right. It's all about that.
Let's go to Manitoba in Canada. Hey, David, go ahead.
Good, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try to do this as brief as possible. I know there's many people calling. Basically, what happened was my mother told me when I was about probably between 6 to 8 months old, so that was back in 65. She had left me in the car with my dad, you know, because I was sleeping to go visit some friends, and it was just like right close by.
Mm-hmm.
She came back to check on me. Now, I couldn't give you any kind of a time zone here, but we're probably looking at about at least a minimum of 10 minutes. She came down to the back seat, check on me. My eyes were rolled back. My face was blue. My lips were blue, and she was freaking out. She's screaming for my dad. I wasn't breathing. There was just nothing. They drove as fast as they could to the hospital. And during this time, my mother was kind of opening the window and pushing her stomach, and she really didn't know what to do. I guess they really didn't have, like, you know, like first aid so available that you knew exactly what to do type thing. But I was out the whole time until we reached the hospital. So we're looking at least probably a minimum of 10 minutes at all. But during that time, she happened to notice something in the corner of her eye in the back seat. She had a quick little glimpse and then didn't really think much of it. Now, I said to the person I spoke to before, you know, who kept putting me on hold, that was my great-grandmother. But I just found out recently that basically it was my great-great-grandmother, because my mother just received pictures back from an uncle who passed away and saw a young woman, and she said, that is the woman that was sitting in my back seat.
I love it.
Which would have been my great-great-grandmother. And ever since that has happened, I don't know if this has any relation whatsoever, but ever since this has happened, I've gone to, like, old towns, like, say, Tombstone or Bodie, California, for example. There are these, like, ghost town type things. They call them ghost towns, but not really Tombstone. And I have found myself that I can see things that were there at one time, but they're just, like, kind of the corner of my eye, like my mom said.
Bill, another remarkable story, and we'll be right back with more final stories right here on Coast to Coast AM. You've been doing this for a long time, Bill, so I assume you've decided that this is your passion. This is what you're going to do.
So, yes. Formally began our research in 1988, but really began in 1977 when I was attending that five-day workshop with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, where
yes.
I heard the first ADC I ever came across.
Okay, let's go to final calls. We'll go to Staten Island, New York, to start this segment, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Brian. You're up with us.
Thank you, George, for taking my call. I want you to know I've been listening to you for years. This is my first time calling, really appreciate you taking my call.
Of course.
I have had dear friends pass away, and I have had family members pass away. I've never had dreams about friends who passed away, but yet I've always had dreams about family members. My mom passed away 20 years ago, and I had a very, very powerful dream with her in it, where she gave me numbers that actually came out that night. She appeared to be much younger than she was when she passed on, and that was the first dream I had ever had of somebody who passed. Now, my brother had passed very recently, within a couple of years, and right after he passed, within 2 weeks, very strong dream where when I woke up, I felt like I was actually with him. And my father had passed away. And before my father had passed, he'd given us clear instructions on how he wanted things done when he had passed. And I really didn't follow them, and I kind of made some waves with his wife. And in the dream, he was really, really annoyed. And I was just wondering, is this the way is this them coming through to me, actually, for real?
What do you think, Bill?
The mother, yes. Gave him, I guess, lottery numbers or something like
right,
that.
Right, something like that.
And the brother seemed a positive thing. I think you're really asking about your father and his disapproval of your not
following his instructions.
Following his wishes. From what I understand, you know, just because somebody dies, they leave their physical body, that's the only change, doesn't mean that they change in personality in any other way. Doesn't mean that they're enlightened. Doesn't mean that they're all-knowing or all anything. So to carry something like that for a little while, why not?
I mean, reverse
the roles. If you had expressed your wishes to your father and you had died, you might be a little bit upset that he didn't follow them. Now, I'm not saying you should go on a guilt trip. Don't hear me that way. But I'm just saying I can understand that in terms of personalities.
Hey, Bill, suppose what you just said, your personality pretty much is what it is when you pass away as it was when you were alive. Suppose you suffer from mental illness like schizophrenia or something like that.
Yeah.
And you pass away, please don't let me think that the poor souls have
those,
to go.
Those are illnesses.
Like
that's
that.
An illness, whatever you want to call it, schizophrenia, this or that. Those are biochemical illnesses that are attached with a physical body.
They don't move on with the soul, do they?
No.
So yeah. Once they pass, they're functioning.
Right. Yes, they're functioning normally.
Whatever normal is.
Whatever their normal would be, yes.
Mm-hmm. By the way, George?
Yeah, Brian.
I just finished a book by Lawrence E. Joseph, Apocalypse 2012.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good guest. It's a good book. It might be something you might want to look into.
Super. Okay, thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Next up, Sacramento we go. Stephanie, west of the Rockies, good morning.
Good morning to you, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
My good friend, Lori, in 1997, we knew at that time that she wasn't going to have too much longer to live. So her and I, after years of friendship, decided to have a long goodbye celebration of our friendship and a thank you. And it was just a beautiful day-long conversation of every kind of wonderful connection you could imagine before she went home to Colorado to be with her son to die. On that day, we made a pact to each other and a promise that she had faith in psychic abilities and in my psychic abilities. You know, that's neither here nor there, but she has faith in it. And so we made a promise to each other that from her side, when she got home, and that is to heaven or whatever you want to call that dimension, that she would do her best to try to contact me, and I would do my best to be open to it, to prove that there is, without a shadow of a doubt, life after death. And I'm here to tell you that with every fiber of my being, I'm vibrating right now to get the impression across of how real this is. She came through in a dream. But it was a dream that was more real than anything I've ever imagined in this living life that I've lived. And I'll be 40 next month, in fact. And this was in, like I said, 1997. It was everything about her. To call her earlier that it mentioned heat waves off of a hot car or off of a hot road, it vibrated like that, the glow about her. Her hair breathed with life. It was literally breathing. The fabric of the clothing that she had on when she turned around, and I, you know, because I woke up with a card invitation in my hand and just knew I was supposed to be somewhere. And I was standing in a foggy area, and then all of a sudden I realized there's these doors standing in front of me. They're huge, two doors, 20 feet tall easily. And I just kind of reached for the handles, but there's no handles, and they swing open. And later on, I realized that my mother, actually, who died in 1994, was the person who greeted me at the door and brought me into the room, which, in a sense, looked like a bar room or a gathering place of sorts, with nothing but shadowy figures. You know, I couldn't see details, but I saw and heard details of, you know, loud chattering and glasses and everything tinkling and people. And then Lori, my friend, turned around to face me, and I was so shocked. I said, "Oh my God, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be dead." And this is, oh my God, this is so beautiful. And I can remember every detail of the entire occasion, every breath, every word, every the vibration that goes through me just at remembering me holding her. And then 6 months later, approximately, I realized that it was my mother. It came to me finally that my mother was the one who greeted me at the door and brought me to Lori. And she had said to me when she greeted me at the door, you know, because I freaked when I saw her, and I said, "Mom, you're dead. Oh, my God, what are you doing here? This is so cool." She said, "Baby, this one's not about us. This one's not about me. This one's for you. And this is your promise with Lori that you guys, you know, that you guys made." And it was just the most beautiful experience. And I've experienced some beautiful experiences, being that I am psychically connected, and I'm telling you that we don't die when we die. This continues. This is, you know, and I've connected with many more people after death and didn't even know them in life, and had the people in front of me who I was speaking to about this connection validate for me that that was really who I was speaking to.
Well, you know, Bill, and let me tell you, along with Stephanie's story, if one doesn't believe in life after death after a night like tonight, you never will. You know?
And that's the beauty of Hello from Heaven, because it's not an intellectual book where we excerpt from all different experiences. It contains 353 firsthand accounts, and the experience is all in words. Each one's a complete short story. So it's from beginning to end, and the reader arrives at their own conclusions. So you can imagine how powerful Hello from Heaven is when you, if you read one story a day or one page or 10 pages or whatever.
In the dream state, is it the dreamer or is it the entity, the spirit, that is making it happen?
I want to say it's a meeting somewhere in time.
Yeah.
I can't answer that. No.
Let's go to Chuck, truck driving in Wyoming. Hey, Chuck, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Bill. And,
yes, sir.
Hi, George.
Good to have you.
Thank you. Real quick, I had an ex-wife. I was married to her for about 10 years, and we got divorced. She had a son, so I had a stepson, and I haven't talked to them or heard from them in any form or manner for about 16 years or so now. But about 8 months ago, I had this dream. I call it sleep stage or whatever, and I saw both of them. And they were just letting me know everything was okay. Then I had another one about a month later, and it was just her, just my ex. And I knew my son was okay. I knew my former son, stepson was okay. But I have a feeling she has passed on. Well, today, he finally found me on one of those internet sites where, you know, I don't know if I can say the name or not.
Well, you did a search for you.
Well, he found me.
Yeah.
And said he's been trying to find me, and I have not received an email back from him yet. I responded to it. So this will be one of those follow-ups I'll have to give you all later, because I asked how his mother's doing and everything, and I have not heard back from him yet. But I have a feeling I'm going to get the news.
Yeah.
But she was letting me know then that it was okay. I had actually hurt her pretty bad back then, and when we got our divorce, I had a bad case of judgment and stuff. And
you're ready for this, though, now, aren't you?
I'm ready for it. I am ready for it. But I do have an idea here for George, too, because he, remember, all these near-death experiences and all these passing on always seems to be sort of a pleasant sort of a situation, and people are more or less happy. And that's because death belongs to God. It's not whether you're good, bad, or indifferent, until the judgment comes, you belong to Him. And He's taking you to the place wherever it is.
What's your take on that, Bill? Let's get Bill's reaction, Chuck, to this.
Okay. I'd rather not get into anything theological on this, because my views are somewhat different.
Okay. That's fair. Thanks, Chuck. Let's go to Terry in Cerritos, California. Hey, Terry, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to relay something real quick that happened to me many years ago. I was, one of the great years of your life is summers of your life is after your senior year in high school and you're going to college, that summer. And I was having a great summer, and I was working in a furniture store. And before I was going to go off to college, it wasn't that much longer before I was. And I had a dream about a guy that I'd gone to high school with that I'd been in my church choir with. And I knew him, and I knew his brother better. But I didn't know him all that well, and I'm going to get to the real question here in a second, but I dreamed about him that night, and I had a very vivid dream, and he came to my and talked to me, and we, we just had discussions, and he said something. I can't remember exactly the conversation now. It's been 35 years or so. But anyway, I didn't think much about it, except I told my mom. I said, I had a really kind of strange dream last night about, you know, I gave the name. And I went to work that day. I worked in a furniture store for the summer, and the furniture store owner came over to me. He says, do you know such and such? I go, yeah, yes. And he goes, well, I just got the strangest news. I know his dad, he died last night. They were parking in the car. It was. I'm from around Ohio, the Ohio River Valley, and it was like August, and it can get a little cold at night there, and even then. And he was parking with his girlfriend in a car. They hadn't got the muffler fixed, and they turned the car on. You know, they're out in some kind of lover's lane or whatever it was, and the carbon monoxide killed him in the car. And I said, you know, that's the strangest thing. I said it to the owner. I said, I dreamed about that guy last night, you know. And my question to you is, do you have acquaintances coming to people, not just family members, just somebody that you knew but not even wasn't one of your best friends? Do you ever have many stories of that?
Yes, it can be, because maybe let's say I want to get through to this person, but they're filled with grief or something, I can't. But I can come to you with a hope that I can give you a message, or just the very fact I've come to you at all, and you see me and you know I'm well and happy and all that, that you'll deliver that as a message to the
world. You know, an addendum to that is, as I just thought about it just now, one of my sister's best friends was with his brother. And they're the ones that found him, because he didn't come home early, and they were looking for him, and they found the car, and they found him, the car still running, and they found him dead in the car. So maybe that was it, because my sister and she was at our house that night crying, because she witnessed the bodies and everything.
Yeah, that's
so maybe that was sort of
a very traumatic, to come across two people who have just died.
Yeah, they were 18 years old. 19,
and
18
carbon monoxide is not an easy way to die.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just wanted to know, you know, because you guys have all been talking about family members and things like that. I had a similar. I don't really know. I could have just been coincidence, you know. Maybe there was something floating out there about it, and I just picked it up. But, you know, anyway, I'll let somebody else get on.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Are there any special times when these visitations occur more than the others? I mean, Christmas or anything like that?
Many people have these, not so much when they want them, but when they need them the most. There's one time.
Good point.
It's not necessarily a birthday or anniversary day, but when they're emotionally open on the one hand and most would benefit the most from having it. It's a hard way to express it with words here, but when they need it the most.
When one is at their most darkest moments.
Perhaps. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It happens that way, doesn't
then,
it?
Then too. Mm-hmm.
Okay, next up we go to maybe final caller, maybe one more after this. First-time caller, hey, Franny in Louisiana. Go ahead, Franny.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Most interesting.
Only got a couple minutes, so go for it.
The spring of 76, I took a class on death and dying based on the work of Elizabeth Kubler Ross and Raymond Moody. And I went on to get my graduate degree then, and then I worked with hospice and with elderly in the psych unit and hospitals. So most of my patients by now have all died. And in addition to that, I want to thank you for validating some personal experiences that I've had. I've had six communications following death. And you are absolutely right in my case about the length of time after death that they came unsolicited to me. The ways of communication, the types of messages, and the clear memories of the two dreams in which two of them appeared, and these were the two violent deaths, and they were of the same nature. I just want to thank you, and I appreciate your work. This is most interesting. Please continue it, and good luck.
All right, there you go, Bill.
Thank you very much.
About a minute or so to go. Please give out your websites. Tell us about that incredible CD again, and thank you for being on the program.
afterdeath.com. And the incredible CD, which was played earlier, is Until We're Together Again. And you can get be directed from our website to hers, or go directly to hers, which is spiritlyric.com. That's S-P-I-R-I-T, Spirit Lyric, L-Y-R-I-C. Those two words together, spiritlyric.com. And you can hear the song as often as you want for free, and you can order it and buy it. And many people use it for funerals. They use it for memorial services and other times like that, or for bereavement support groups. And it's a beautiful song, and I urge people to think of giving this song and also hello from heaven as gifts to people who are bereaved. I'm not saying that to sell books. That's not about money. It's about helping people who are grieving the death of a loved one. And I'd like to wind up by saying if 60 million Americans or 120 million Americans have had an experience, then I believe this should be viewed as a natural and normal part of life.
You're very helpful to a lot of people, Bill. Thank you so much. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Pundit and Art Bell, I'm George Norris, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.